Welcome to All Write in Sin City, a podcast about writers and writing in the Windsor, Detroit region. Your podcasters today are
Irene Moore Davis, author, educator, and local historian.
Sarah Jarvis, former bookseller, publishing rep, and literary festival chair.
And me, Kim Conklin, Windsor-based writer and filmmaker.
Kate Hargreaves is the author of the poetry collection Leak, as well as Jammer Star, a roller derby novel for young readers, and Talking Derby, a book of prose vignettes. She holds an MA in English and Creative Writing from the University of Windsor, where she received the Governor General's Gold Medal in Graduate Studies. Her work has appeared in literary journals across Canada, the US, and the UK. As a book designer for numerous Canadian presses, Hargreaves has received honors from the Alcuin Society for Excellence in Book Design, the CBC Bookie Awards, and the Book Publishers Association of Alberta. She grew up in Amherstburg, Ontario, and lives and works in Windsor. Her latest poetry collection, published by Book Hug Press in October 2022, is Tend. Welcome, Kate Hargreaves.
Thank you so much for having me.
When and how did you first fall in love with writing?
Oh boy. probably when I was like a very young child. I was the kid who was, I know it's probably a cliche, but I was the kid who was always writing a million stories when I was a little kid. And I was, you know, in school writing books and drawing the pictures and doing the thing where you get to bind them with the spiral bind machine that makes that really satisfying noise. And that's one of my strongest memories from being in elementary school is just making little books all the time. So I guess kudos to the teachers who were allowing us to do that and encouraging us to do that. So I'd make these little books all the time. I never really thought anything of becoming a writer. I think I wanted to be a school teacher when I was a kid. But then when I was in, I think the eighth grade, I wrote a little book about circuses and how they're detrimental to animals. I guess I was having the beginning of my vegetarianism. So I was having a bit of an animal rights moment. And my teacher shared it with Marty Gervais, which I'd never met him before. And he ended up writing about it in his column in the paper. And that was sort of my first brush with publishing. So nothing obviously ever came out of the book that I wrote in the eighth grade, but years later when I ended up working with Marty, when I was doing some work for the Windsor Review and Black Moss Press, I brought it up with him and he went, "Oh my goodness, that was you." So it's been a long time thing. And my grandmother, who she lived in England the whole time when I was a kid, but she was always obsessed with words and telling me the meanings of all these words that I'd never heard. And that's partially where the name of my design company when I was doing book design came from, is Coruscate Press, because she told me to coruscate is the verb for what fireflies do, the kind of the glowing that they do. And being a small child and just learning all of these strange words from my grandmother, and she used to do the crypto quote in the paper and taught me how to make crypto quotes when I was a kid. So it's just playing with words has always been part of my life. So I guess it kind of just all came full circle when I started writing poems.
I'm glad you brought up your design company. So for much of your career, you've seemed to shift effortlessly between writing and graphic design, especially designing book covers. What impact has your sense of design, that part of your creativity, had on your writing, do you think?
Ooh, that's a good question. From a really boring designer perspective, the idea of designing, writing poems that fit on a book page, it seems like a strange way to think about writing poems. But when I'm writing poems, I need to think about this is not going to appear on an 8.5 by 11 for its entire life as a poem. Probably it will likely end up in a much smaller format. So how is this going to translate to a smaller format? And so I actually, when I do my writing now, I write in a document that's formatted for, you know, like a 6 by 9, even in the word processor, because I don't want to have to deal with fixing line breaks later in the event that it ends up getting published in, you know, a journal that's not an, just an online journal, if it's going to be a journal that's print and also online, or if it's going to end up in a book someday. Because I've had so many difficult conversations with authors as a designer to say, hi, actually, we have to break this line because it can't be, your lines and your poems can't be 8.5 inches wide. So from a purely practical perspective, that kind of ties in. And on the other hand, I think as a designer, the way that I approach design comes a lot of out of the way that I approach poetry, and that a lot of it comes out of the mood or the tone of something, especially when you're designing a poetry book. It's not like you're looking for the main theme necessarily, because sometimes there's not, or a collection of short stories. It's kind of just based on vibes. So as a poet, I found that I could pull the tone out of something a little bit more comfortably than I expected that I'd be able to when I was doing book designs, especially when I was given free rein. So it's one of those things where it's hard to describe to somebody how the ideas are coming to you, but it's sort of based on this, this is wrong for the tone and I can't explain why. So this is why we need another version.
I think it's really normal to think about the visual aspect of writing, but that's just me. So yeah. In this collection and elsewhere, the minimalist, almost surgical precision with which you choose your words is very powerful. You know how to, and I'm quoting here, strip words like veins from a leg or bones from a fish. So would you say that you're more ruthless of, as an editor of your own work these days than you used to be? How has that changed?
I think in terms of how I'm editing my own work, it's, I try to have other people's voices in my head a little bit and take a step away from it. And admittedly, even thinking back to what my professors at university would say, like, what would Susan Holbrook or Nicole Mercotic say about this poem? And where would they put a big, you know, cross out through and say, okay, this is a cliche, get rid of this. So I'm usually my own worst critic, but in order to do my editorial, I kind of have to take a step back and say, okay, what would somebody whose opinion I really respect on these poems think about them? But I do like to cut things down to kind of their bare basic necessities. I don't like a lot of kind of extraneous words and they're cluttering up the place. And I think for, in terms of how that's changed over time, this book's actually a lot more, I was nervous about it because it's a lot more vulnerable than my first poetry book. I think I kind of hid behind the wordplay a little bit more in the first poetry book. And this one has a few more sort of emotionally vulnerable lyric moments in it. And putting it out actually was a little bit nerve-wracking because I thought, oh, is there not enough kind of interesting stuff happening with the words? Is this just too many feelings? And I think it's just my instinct is to sort of put up a wall of puns and gore. So I kind of had to take down some of that.
How have other people responded to that different approach? Have you heard anything back from your readers?
Yeah, I think my friend, she's also a very talented poet, Skylar Kay. She's wonderful, and I really respect her work as well. And she said that she much prefers it to the first book, that she prefers that vulnerability. And she says it kind of feels more connected, I guess, for her as a reader. I don't want to misquote her, but but I've heard from other people too that the balance is a little bit better, that there's the playfulness and there is the pulling language apart and putting it back together, but having a few of those more vulnerable moments makes it a little bit more mature.
So Tend, which is the title of one of your poems and the title of this collection, of course, has multiple meanings, right? But above all, it brings together poems about caring for ourselves and for one another, caring for nature, tending a garden, looking after animals, and really caring about soft, gentle, broken, or fragile things in a world that can be harsh at times. How did this project begin for you, and how surprised were you by where it ended up?
Well, very surprised. This project went on a journey. Initially, this project, when I started writing the poems for it, or some of the poems that appear in it, I thought I was going to be writing something about how I'm obsessed with bodies, as is probably evident, something about how we interact with our bodies in terms of movement and exercise, and how those things can be both liberating but also traumatic. And I kind of hit a wall with that project and kind of put it away. I didn't come back to it. And then a little while later, I thought I was going to, you know, write a collection that really explored the ways that curated online culture can make us feel like we're not enough, and how those feelings kind of circulate. And then I kind of hit a wall with that and didn't come back to it, and thought, oh, these are going to never have any relationship to one another. And then in the middle of kind of taking one of those breaks, I had a really severe injury and I broke my leg. I pretty much snapped my shin in half, and it was horrible. It was traumatic, as is probably obvious. It was a huge recovery process. And initially people kept saying, you should write it. You should write through it and it will help you recover. And I was saying, no, this is too much, because the pain was too close. And writing through the pain when you're in the thick of it is, at least for me, for some people that might work, but for me, that was not going to happen. There's no way. So what I ended up doing is saying, no, we're not doing that. And I started, as I was coming out of the recovery, and I mean, three surgeries later and a couple of years later, I'm just finally kind of coming out of that. I started writing poems about plants and about flowers, and poems that kind of reflected, a lot of them ended up reflecting being at home, because all of this happened during COVID. I broke my leg in June of 2020. So right at the beginning of the COVID lockdowns. And the idea of the comfort of being somewhere where you feel safe, and the privilege of feeling safe in your home, but also the idea of feeling so disconnected and feeling trapped in your home, both by, in my case, like literally because I couldn't leave the house because I was stuck on my couch. So all of that kind of came together, and the kind of therapeutic nature of finally being able to get back out into the garden, or learning to walk again in Jackson Park, and kind of shuffling around the flowers and using those as a distraction. So all of that kind of came together. And then in the end, I thought, well, there's no way these are going to go together with the poems that I was writing before. But that idea of looking after what's broken and tending to the places where we're hurting, or where other people are hurting, and just kind of like allowing gentleness as sort of a resistant thing, they ended up kind of slotting together in a way I had never expected. So, I mean, I'm not recommending don't break your leg to write a book of poetry. It's not a great experience. Would not recommend to anybody, but at least that is something that came out of it.
Well, along with Jackson Park and train tracks and the roads they disrupt, and auto plants, the Central Library, the annual fish fly phenomenon, there's such a strong sense of place in this book with those many recognizable Windsor scenes and experiences. Yet these earlier things are described in ways that feel very remarkable and new. So what impact has living in this region had on your writing, and on this collection in particular, other than what you could see from your couch, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I love Windsor. I think Windsor gets a really bad reputation. And I mean, for me, I've been lots of other places and I love living in Windsor. I think there's so much beauty here, and there's beauty in the things that people don't often find beauty in, or that get overlooked, like even just the noises of the trains, and the trains kind of uncoupling in the train yard, and all of those moments. It's not just getting stuck behind a train. So I think, yeah, Windsor, as you said, permeates so much of the writing. And it was in Leek, but I think it's a lot more intent because to a degree, before I broke my leg, and then afterwards in recovering, And just in my day-to-day life, I am I'm a frequent pedestrian. I walk pretty much everywhere. And so I experience the city, a lot of the central parts of the city, through walking. And that those moments of slowing down, especially when you're forced to slow down and you're walking really slow, and experiencing the world around you and interacting with human beings on a level that you can't really do from the confines of a vehicle, like from a car. It's so much different. And so much of my writing came from walking around and having ideas when I was walking, and my brain really gets going when I'm walking. So I think that's why there's so many squirrels too. I learned that, I guess, squirrels are particularly prolific here. I asked some people online and said, people keep commenting on the number of squirrels in this book. And I thought squirrels were everywhere in every city, but I guess Windsor is very squirrel heavy. So I thought it was really funny that even the squirrels, even the animals, the wildlife is very particular to Windsor. And also they're an overlooked piece of wildlife. People don't really think about the squirrels. I don't think a lot of the time they're almost like people think of them like rats kind of, and rats too, like they're fine. They're just doing their thing. So, the walking around and slowing down, I think is where a lot of the Windsor comes into it. And that's why it seems very particular too, to sort of the most walkable areas of Windsor, to downtown, to the West End, to a degree to Walkerville, but a lot of it's really centered around downtown. And that kind of Tecumseh train yard area, because, you know, those are the places that are accessible by foot for me. And those are the places where I kind of find that unexpected beauty.
You talked a little bit about discovering, you know, gentleness as a kind of resistance and that kind of thing while you were working on this book. What do you think or hope that other readers will take away from this collection? What would you like them to get out of reading it?
I think for me, just kind of that idea of slowing down and looking at things, looking at revaluing things that you maybe hadn't thought about, taking the time to look at. Looking at the dusty things, the broken things, both, you know, physically, you know, in our day-to-day lives, what we don't maybe notice or take the time to appreciate, but also maybe in ourselves and like that sort of more introspective metaphorical sense, and giving those things some care and some grace and allowing ourselves to not be quite so harsh. And seeing that as a way to resist the harshness of experience that happens a lot. I think that idea of revaluing is something that is important through a lot of the poems, and just taking a different perspective and slowing down, and making those connections with people. Because I think a lot of the time in the poems, there's an idea of this contrast between disconnect and connect with people because of sort of the way that the disconnect was sort of enforced on me as a writer when I was doing it again and being, you know, trapped in my living room and just watching people go by. But it really emphasized the need to connect with our communities and the need to be part of something, and to kind of reach out. So I think that's one of the things that I think would be important for people to pull from this.
Are you working on any new material currently?
Ooh, right now, I have a chapbook that is going to be coming out with Zad Press. That's sort of like, it's fiction, but it's sort of poem-y fiction. So it's a little bit hybrid, in terms of its form. And so that's coming out this year. So I've just been working on doing some edits with the folks at Zed Press. So that's, in terms of writing, I haven't been doing a lot of new stuff because I've been focused on those edits, but, I'm not sure what's going to be next in terms of writing. I'm working on a master's thesis right now. So, I've been reading a lot about trauma-informed pedagogy. So it's a little bit, related to TEND, I guess, and related to trauma and bodies and, you know, giving people the space that they need to experience their own feelings and feel safe. So I guess it does tie in somehow, but it's a little bit more of an academic writing project at the moment.
Would you like to read something for our listeners?
Yeah, for sure. I'd love to. Any preferences?
I think the title poem is wonderful. That's a good one. And the one about the hawk is assumed risk, please.
Yes. That's my poem for my cat winner. So this is the title poem, Tend, which I think is probably the closest thing I've ever written to a love poem. And it's that vulnerability factor you can tell because it's really, really short. Tend. We tend toward moot, curl into dim morning, set birdsong to snooze, ears plugged against purrs, press mint from a tube, a cult of warm mugs, fridge hums, brand spills, I sip, you broom. Find the hawk poem. Yeah, this one came out of my cat when I was, finally getting to adventure out into the yard, and my cat would hide under a chair as if he was going to get swooped by a hawk. So there's a lot of cats in this book as well. A hawk is implied risk when you're a cat in the yard, with the nerve to paw the kitchen tile beside your bowl, the ocean whitefish and tuna dinner subpar. Pushing past the gapping screen doors with grand plans of escape from the armchair and choice of quiet nooks that restrain you from your call to catch an evisceration of small animals, crickets, and those bugs that glow, taunting you nightly through the paw-marked glass, gnawing and discarding green tomatoes in the weeds, discounting the fleet of your claws, your needle teeth, limited to couch shredding and occasional blood. Ears flicking to follow every rustle and creak without corner cobwebs, a lone black spider to trace for hours. Now just leaves and wires and sky. Any dark speck at risk of a swoop, some creature you've never known but feel only as a tingle in the scruff of your neck. Outside just too open. Every thermal a threat. So you with the teeth, claws trimmed monthly for treats, hunker under a folding chair, jump at the twitch of a grasshopper, and plan to gut any squirrel that approaches. So I think I'll read one of the ones from the last section, which is one of the ones that comes in different parts. So while we're on the garden theme, this one's called Bolt. When the lettuce bolted, shot to seed and tipped in the storm. Tomatoes worked through the fence, dropping green fruit, choking out the blueberry bush. What is a weed if it flowers, draws butterflies to the window in orange and black relief? The clover hasn't quite seeded, but I root for the tiny clusters to outgrow hungry spadgers and thrive. Deadwood climbs tall as children and bursts with pink blooms. I nearly uprooted them. Some things just need time. I write the flowers down, learn their leaves and colors and names to call to the bees. 2. Sweet woodruff for humility hewn from its temporary bed. Forget zinnia seeds until they sprout absent friends. What's a weed but a yarrow time under grub-eaten leaves crawling for blue salvia? I think of you until I don't. Rhododendron grows over dead cedar. Peonies too lush to be bashful. Plant a full bed of distrust. Lavender for luck, ivy and invasive fidelity married to the soil, unassuming dill claims to guard against evil, a folly of columbine, a recovery of poppies. 3. The pumpkin vine rots at its base, but crawls on across pebbles, content to open orange blossoms every morning and close again by noon. Knows it cannot sustain a gourd like the marrows that lengthen all summer into fall. I choose a pumpkin-colored sleeper, the size of a fennec fox today, she says, or some fancy French cake or a camping lantern. I thumb board books about black cats and pumpkins, coo at impossibly small and unnecessary shoes, buy a new litter box so that the cat will stop shitting on the floor. 4. chopping back the rose of Sharon, tossing buds out of season to bloom in heavy piles to dry and shrink. I sweat early fall hacking telltale roses with Stevie Nicks on repeat, planting seeds out of season. I don't have the triceps or the snips for thick branches that snap rainwater across my face and shelter thorns with fairy tale intentions. So I figured if I talked about so much about the leg trauma that I should read one of the poems that kind of deals with that directly. So this one is against capital letters. An L, he repeats, not an I, but an L, forms the letter with thumb and fingers for effect. Someone's hand grips a knee, my hand, someone's hand with blood drying between fingers. L is the limit. Flesh is liminal. Firefighters hose away what's left. L is an intersection, an affront of angles, of compound serifs, of bone. So I don't know if the, I don't know how many minutes that was, but if that's good, we're good. Or if you want any more.
I mean, I could use a couple more.
Sure, sure. I say, I liked your preferences before. Some of those were ones I don't read that often. So I like that. So I'll read another, so to give the county some love, because I grew up in Amherstburg, this is my county poem. This is July. The shivering off of translucent exteriors, less snake-like than half-life fish fly out in Bell River mid-July, shedding crisp shadows of past selves, identical cast-offs on the breeze. Flick off your porch light or risk a swarm, freshly molted masses in search of any glow. Vestigial mouths brush ears, feet grow sticky in hair, tell us the water is growing clearer. Abandoned skins collecting in porch corners, a sign of good health. In the county, they send cars fishtailing on carcasses, popping under tire treads like a fire pit, spitting embers that leave tiny burns in the two long sleeves of your jumper. The shower coaxes the wood smoke from your hair, macerates all that's between your toes, softens calluses that forget the feel of floors. The funny thing about that one is that the wonderful copy editor at Book Hug had circled county and put country. And I said, oh no, that's a Windsor thing. Like we all call it the county apparently, and more things that I realize are regional. I could not believe how many things were regional when I was writing this book and going through the publishing process. It was very funny. So I will read, I'll read the last one because it's also very much a Windsor poem about the trains. And it's also a nostalgic poem that kind of pulls back to some childhood experiences with my grandma in England. So this one's called Root. When. Some people only take root near water, tug toward walkable riversides that mark north or west or uptown or home. Landlock rises in throats and draws pulses faster. Fields and flats close like walls and traps, but currents crack back doors. Two. The lurch of cars uncoupling, fog muffling horn softens my jaw and loosens cramps. The heavy comfort of train yards through rain and open windows. Three, a railway garden over a crumbling wall where elderflower wine takes root. Red foxes quick step past bedroom windows, pausing to peek in at suitcases, dolls, damp washing, steaming on rats. Four, the trains back home crawl, but the ones here move like ghosts, don't rattle the plants on the windowsill. Did we really play on that wall hoisted into the railway garden to pause time and rescue snails? Five, she teaches the alchemy of nettle stings, prickling across ankles to soothe with dock leaves. We don't have this magic back home. Six, stinging nettle drives out curses, brews tea against weakness. I collect its sharp leaves in my side, permanent ties to the trains, the wall, a lifelong debt of hives.
Kate Hargreaves, thank you so much for joining us. The collection is tanned and it is wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a wonderful experience.
Today, we have a uniquely local book. The City of Windsor, through the Poet Laureate and Storytellers Program, is gearing up for the upcoming launch of the fifth book in the city's
South Shore Collections series. These books help capture, preserve, and share Windsor stories with the community, one of the primary goals of the program. The book is being published by Windsor's Black Moss Press in partnership with the City of Windsor and the University of Windsor's Editing and Publishing Practicum Program. Additional support for the publication comes from the Canada Council for the Arts and Museum Windsor. 13 well-known local authors are featured in the collection. They are Barry Brody, Carlinda Delamonte, Irene Moore Davis, Peter Hrastovac, Maya Jessup, Dorothy Mahoney, Christopher Lawrence Bernard, Marianne Mulhern, Rowan Mustafa, Andre Narbonne, Vanessa Shields, Laurie Smith, and TJ Travis. Next, we'll hear some selections from the book. Poet introductions will be read by All Right in Sin City co-host Sarah Jarvis. First, we'll hear a poem by TJ Travis. His poem, Bemused, will be read by fellow contributor Irene Moore Davis, also one of our All Right in Sin City co-hosts.
TJ Travis is an Afro-Indigenous multidisciplinary and performance artist based in Wai'wai'atanon. In 2022, he was appointed the inaugural Multicultural Community Storyteller for the City of Windsor, an extension of the Poet Laureate Program. He serves as curator for Sacred Story Studio and the host of A Blaze of Story. These are storytelling initiatives he founded for the purpose of ancestral story preservation. His work can be found on the pages of several poetry anthologies.
Bemused by T.J. Travis. Dear Swan, may I rest my dreams upon the feet of your feathered steel, scribble scattered love languages into the billow of your vanishing trail, part the wandering shadows from tumbling stars, graffiti hieroglyphs into your wings. May I etch scripture puzzles onto the pocket of your breast, hatch callous meanderings against the curtain of time, obscure the secrets of unhoused saints and how they play charades with vintage war plans. Dear magical mischief, you are my shape-shifting sun, my tormented hallelujah, the reason I walk into waves, drag feet through granite gardens, and eavesdrop on the moon while it lullabies your rest to sleep.
Next, we'll hear the poem that inspired the title of the book. Here's Sarah with more on the poet.
Rowan Mustafa is a Palestinian Syrian student and writer living in Windsor, Ontario. She draws inspiration from her religious perspective as a Muslim woman and from social justice causes. She is particularly impassioned by the struggles and resilience of Palestinians living in exile or under occupation.
Now, here's Immigrant, read by the poet Rowan Mustafa.
Immigrant. I find myself in the middle space of audio corridor, in the dissonance of metallic bones, in the frustration of the wind, in the gaps of river and sky, in this open air prison. I find myself always in the middle space. This corridor has no entrance, no exit. In is out, out is in. I find myself moving through. Cold clangor melts into maple currents. O wind, O love, take me to my country.
Finally, we'll hear the closing poem from the book, In the Middle Space, read by Irene Moore Davis. Sarah will introduce the poet, Christopher Lawrence Bernard.
Christopher Lawrence Bernard is a playwright of shows such as The Best Man, The View from Here, and The Drag Trilogy. He's also a screenwriter of the films Whatever It Was and Gary Blaze, as well as acting as a poet, actor, director, and singer. He published his first book of poetry, At the End, Beginnings, with Black Moss Press. He He lives along Lake Erie with his husband, their young son, and their dog.
Gateway by Christopher Lawrence Menard. On the final leg of our long journey back, we are caught in a twisted lane at the duty-free, waiting our turn for the swab, the test that will tell them it is safe to let us return to a country we left 1 week ago after staying firmly in place for 2 years. With papers in hand that they won't ever read, we drive onto the bridge rising over the river in this place where water and metal connect worlds, where I breathe deep and feel calm at the sight of the park up ahead, down below. This magical place I have always known, where bears dance and birds take flight, where horses run and butterflies soar, where the chicken lays the egg and the queen stands by her king, where an apple is bitten, offered, and elephants march to the beat of stainless steel pipes that clang in the wind. At the halfway point between two pillars, I look out and up at the towering red sign, smile wide, close my eyes, feel the wind as the ambassador welcomes me home.
The launch event for the book takes place Thursday, April 6th, 2023 at 7 p.m. at Mackenzie Hall Cultural Center. Tickets are free and can be reserved through eventbrite.ca. In the Middle space will be available for purchase at the launch event. After the launch, you can find it online at the Black Moss Press website. It will also soon be available at the gift shop at Museum Windsor's Chimchuck Museum and at Biblioasis Bookshop in Windsor and River Bookshop in Amherstburg.
Thanks for joining us. Look for more episodes of All Right in Sin City wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out our website, allrightinsincity.com. For information and announcements of new podcasts, sign up to our email list or follow us on Facebook and Twitter.